coming up, how Mitt Romney dodged the draft. Yes, former governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney actually dodged the draft. We're going to tell you the story of how that happened. Mitt Romney dodging the draft is the subject of H. Bruce Franklin's piece in the new issue of the Counterpunch Political Newsletter. Franklin was at Stanford teaching English while Romney was a first-year college student in 1965. By then, Bruce Franklin had flown for 3 years in the United States Air Force as a Strategic Air Command navigator and intelligence officer. He's been teaching a course on the Vietnam War since 1981 at Rutgers University with veterans among his students. H. Bruce Franklin is a cultural historian and professor of English there. He's worked in factories and was a tugboat mate and a deckhand. He also happens to have taught at Stanford, Johns Hopkins, Wesleyan, and Yale University. Among his 19 books that he's edited or written are War Stars, The Superweapon, and The American Imagination. Bruce Franklin, thank you so much for joining us today, and welcome.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
Good to have you with us. I'm so interested to hear about, when did you start to hear this story about Romney? Did you actually know back in the time, around 1965, that did you happen to actually know Mitt Romney?
I don't think so. I mean, for all I know, he could have been in a class of mine, but I sure don't remember it.
But you were there around the time that Stanford students were protesting the Vietnam War then, when he was there as a first-year student.
Yes, they were protesting the war, and specifically what they were protesting was the draft, and more specifically than that was the draft deferment test that was being rolled out that month. It was May of 1965. Up to that point, there was a college deferment, a 2S deferment that people could get, and it was based on being in college and class rank and grades. Well, this was unfair enough because, of course, it meant that young men who were unable to go to college or didn't want to go to college were subject to the draft, where people in college, if they maintained certain class rank and grades, were exempt from the draft. They started getting to be a protest from people at the really elite universities saying, oh, well, this is really unfair because someone who was less intelligent could be in the top quarter of his class at some state college, whereas at Stanford or Harvard, someone could be in the bottom quarter of the class and be more intelligent.
The way it used to be done, the first way these 2S deferments were tested, you could say it was almost more equal. It was giving a greater chance to people across the socioeconomic spectrum, people across the spectrum of how well anyone happens to be doing with grades based on some test in college. In other words, it was that the people who performed in the top 25% at each college, not nationwide top 25%, right?
Yeah. There was a certain amount of equity there, but basically it was extremely unfair to all the people who were not in college. It's obviously something passed, surprise, surprise, by the relatively wealthy people who make our laws. But then in order to supposedly level the playing field, which they rolled out in May of 66, this draft deferment test, which is going to be given on college campuses. This, of course, made a standardized test the thing that was going to decide whether you got this precious 2S deferment, or we got shipped off to Vietnam. So so students were protesting against this. The fact that the draft deferment test was being given on campus meant that the movement really had something right there on campus. Now, one of the things I really want to stress about this is that among the many, many myths that have completely covered up the reality of the Vietnam War and the movement against it, is the idea that the thing that really motivated the student movement was people just wanting to get out of the draft. Well, here you had an example of just the opposite, because the Stanford students, the men, first of all, you know, all those women in the movement, they weren't even subject to the draft. But then the men who were subject, they could have, they could have gone, taken the test, and then we'd gotten their exemption. Instead of that, the ones who were against it actually went in and disrupted the test, protested this, and demanded that college students should not be getting deferments, that there should be real equity. And if it was going to be a draft, everybody should be subject to the draft. And, of course, they were saying there shouldn't be a draft at all because this was an immoral and an unjust war.
You know, I just want to go back one moment to the test, the selective service test, as it was called then in the 1960s. As we're looking at this, it just happens to remind me of a story, before we go on, of something that came out fairly recently. Actually, it was in the recounting of former Massachusetts governor, now presidential candidate, Willard Mitt Romney's time at his private boarding school where he was sent. And the story came out a couple of weeks ago about how he had harassed and pinned down and cut off the hair of a young man who was somewhat effeminate. And later people described him in his adult life as a gay man. And at that time in the 1960s, it was very unusual. Something else that came out about Romney and his academic career and his privilege is that he got into this private school, Cranbrook School, and at a certain point, apparently only the young men with grades in whatever it was, the top 10% or something, were allowed to take an advanced placement course in order to get into more elite colleges, but to do this in private boarding school, like Stanford. And apparently Willard Mitt Romney did not make the cut. He did not make that cut. He was not in. And he, being the son of about to be Governor George Romney at that time, and already a wealthy head of was it AMC, the big auto company that was just growing then. Willard Mitt Romney marched in to an official at the Cranbrook School, the private boarding school, and demanded to be let into this AP course track, the advanced placement courses. He said, he said he should be there. He didn't make the percentage cut, but to heck with that, he was going to walk in, and he demanded, and he got in. So this is partly how he got to Stanford in the first place. I just want to set up that background. But Bruce Franklin, go on. I'm curious to hear more about that Stanford story.
So the Stanford students, they some of them went in and disrupted the test, which jeopardized their own deferments. I mean, that meant they could be drafted. And then students sat in at the president's office. They demanded that Stanford not be participating in this war at all. They shouldn't allow this test on college campuses. And they issued statements, printed statements, which were very interesting, because they said that, you know, the draft has always been an instrument whereby the wealthy and the powerful are able to get other people to fight their wars for them. Well, right on cue, who should appear but Mitt Romney, as part of a demonstration in favor of the war and in favor of the draft. He's waving a sign, and they're talking about their enthusiasm for the war and the draft. Well, this is May 1966. Things were accelerating pretty fast in Vietnam. This was a period of escalation. By this point, there were about 240,000 young men every year being drafted, and so the college deferment didn't look so safe as things were developing. So a lot of young men started flocking to divinity schools to be lining up to be priests and rabbis and ministers and so forth, because that was an even better, more secure deferment. Well, the Latter-day Saints, the Church of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, they had a special thing because in that church, and it's been part of the church for some time, every single young man had to perform 2 years of a mission of service. So they got disqualified to be part of this exemption for ministers. What this meant was that every single young man, Mormon, would automatically qualify. Well,
and that's because the in the Mormon Church, the Church of Latter-day Saints, all young men, the tradition is, become missionary ministers and travel. They're just assigned, whether it's around the United States or in other countries, to go and knock on doors and introduce themselves as Elder Romney or Elder Willard Mitt Romney or Elder whoever it is, wearing the white shirt and the black pants. Many people have experienced this in neighborhoods around Boston and many other cities around the world, including cities around the United States. And my understanding is this tradition also grows out of the male-oriented, male-dominated, really, truly patriarchal Mormon culture. Now, this may be changing, and there are also the few scattered feminist rebel Mormon congregations, but they are not widely accepted, and they certainly were not back in 1965. And this Mormon sort of inner patriarchy, this structure, develops these young men to become ministers. I mean, originally, the man was the minister of the family. The family was the church. The man was a minister and leader of his family. And then, so anyway, this is the kind of setup in the Mormon mindset and Latter-day Saints Church mindset and rooted philosophy, as I understand it, approximately around 1965, certainly going back to the early 1900s. There's Mitt Romney. And there are all these automatic ministers, automatic Mormons, automatic young men, automatically deferred from the draft as they become ministers. But what happens? You say that the U.S. Selective Service System, the draft, the military recognizes this and says, hold on a minute. You can't always all be ministers automatically, all young men who are Mormons, right?
Right. So there was an allocation based on geography. So there would only be one Mormon for each geographic area. Well, there weren't many Mormons in Michigan, and one of them happened to have a father who was governor of the state, and so it wasn't very difficult for Mitt then to get the slot to be a Mormon missionary. And he got this missionary role. It went off to France for two and a half years. So he was enthusiastic for the war, enthusiastic for other people being drafted, but did everything in his power to be absolutely certain that he was not going to be drafted. I titled my article in Counterpunch, The Flight of the Young Chicken Hawk, and I don't know if everybody listening is familiar with that term, but you know, it's such a common feature of American life for the last several decades, that is these chicken hawks, that is people who are really very pro-war, especially the people in power making the wars, sending other people off to fight the wars, but making absolutely certain that they and their sons are not the ones who are going to be doing the fighting. So,
well, I believe
they're that hawks in policy, but chickens when it comes to their personal lives.
And I believe our former President George Bush fit into that category. The younger George Bush, the second Bush president, who sort of barely limped out of his National Guard service, didn't show up. Of course, there was big scandals over this, and apparently. So did Dick Cheney. But anyway, chicken hawks, yeah, as you call them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a real distinction has to be made here, because a lot of people say, well, you know, Bill Clinton, he dodged the draft too, you know. And it's true that he dodged the draft. But I think there's a profound distinction here. And people really need to keep this in mind. That, I mean, if you find a war to be unjust and immoral, then it is immoral for you to go fight in that war. So Clinton was actually doing something that was moral by dodging the draft, because he believed this was an unjust and immoral war. And whereas I think it's profoundly immoral to be in favor of a war, favor of other people going to fight the war, and then doing everything you can to make sure you're not one of those people fighting the war. So I think that Clinton did the right thing. I think it's not on the same level of moral courage as the young men who got sent to prison because they refused to comply with the draft and actually put their own lives at that kind of risk. You know, those people are really heroic. But, you know, Tim O'Brien, our great novelist about the Vietnam War, who was a Vietnam veteran himself, was wounded, has written many times about himself. He said, because he knew that the war was immoral, and what he's written several times is, I was a coward, I went to war. I mean, he recognizes the moral cowardice of people who believe a war is immoral and then allow themselves to go fight in that war.
This is something that may emerge gradually during the rest of the presidential election season. There was some stories about this already in the press this past February, and even going back to a little bit last fall. There's a photograph of Mitt Romney there in his suit jacket and white pants, a black and white photo at Stanford, where he's holding up a sign. And these are young students, all of them white in this photograph, at Stanford, who are protesting the people who are protesting the Vietnam War. So do you remember a President Sterling at Stanford there?
Yeah, Wallace Sterling was the president, and students were actually sitting in his office at that time. In that article in Counterpunch, I quote these really poignant passages and I think wonderful passages from the statement that was issued by those young people sitting in the president's office about the draft and about the war, talking about how the wealthy and the privileged send the poor off to this. And you know, one thing that comes to mind, you compare this, say, to the Hunger Games. You know, in the Hunger Games, there are 24 young people sent off to kill and be killed. By May 66, the time we were talking about, there were 240,000 young Americans being conscripted into the military to go fight this war. That's 10,000 for each one of those 24 that we see in Hunger Games.
There are a lot of young people who may be wondering what the future holds for them in the coming years. Of course, the United States right now is deeply in debt, largely from the Iraq War, the war in Afghanistan that began under President George Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. There's a lot of debt for other reasons as well. But this is an interesting thing for people to know and to learn about Mitt Romney. I wonder if you could offer us, you've taught a course in the Vietnam War for many years, and including to some of your students are veterans of the Vietnam War and veterans of other wars. What do you hear from them that you don't tend to hear from other students?
Well, every single veteran in my course who's come back from the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, they cannot understand why we're doing this. And, now we're supposedly not fighting in Iraq anymore, but we certainly are in Afghanistan. And people come back from that war, and some of them have done multiple tours there. And they say the longer we stay there, the worse the problem is that the longer we stay there, the more the people hate us. So they cannot understand what it is that we think we're accomplishing by fighting there. Now, I'm sure there are some veterans who don't believe that, but and maybe it's a self-selected group that's taking my Vietnam course. However, I know other young men who've fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. I spend a fair amount of time saltwater fishing, and I talk to some of the guys who've come back, and they all say the same thing. And I had one student who was a Marine while he was taking the Vietnam course. This was before the invasion of Iraq in
the invasion began in Iraq 2003.
In 2003, he came back saying we were lied to, and he saying that his unit, and this is a guy, a totally gung ho guy. He was gung ho all throughout the course, you know. But there he is. He's a Marine. He's in the invasion. He said we were in our chemical warfare suits. Our CO is telling us every day, at any moment, you know, Saddam is going to use his arsenal of chemical weapons on us. And he says, we were dying in these suits. It was like 110 degrees. And then one day, a unit of British soldiers came marching by in shorts. And that's when we knew we were being lied to. So they took off their chemical suits and refused to wear them. Because they realized there were no chemical weapons.
H. Bruce Franklin, perhaps time for just a final quick question. You yourself had served in the Air Force, and as I understand, in the Strategic Air Command for 3 years, before you were professor of English at Stanford. When did you develop your opposition to the Vietnam War?
Oh, well, that's a story I've answered at great length in a book called Vietnam and Other American Fantasies. But I couldn't put two and two together, you know, while I was flying. Although, you know, there just seems to be so many strange things. So a lot of the flights we were involved in were refueling bombers. They were flying on missions of espionage and provocation over the Soviet Union. You know, 24 B-47s were shot down over or near the Soviet Union. And we knew in intelligence that the Soviets did not have a way to deliver nuclear bombs to the United States. Now, you know, we're going back in time to 1957, 1958, and yet one of the things we were doing intelligence was trying to keep all the crews convinced that, yeah, at any moment we could be attacked by Soviet bombers. So I didn't understand, you know, I didn't get this. I grew up in World War II. I had that kind of consciousness as a kid, and it wasn't until, oh, I guess it was 62, 63. By the end of 63, 64, I began to get glimmers of what was wrong, not just about the Vietnam War, but the entire framework of the Cold War. It wasn't until much later, you know, as a historian, that I realized that this is a war that we waged really as a proxy war, because we were the ones who financed the French and sent them there, had 250 U.S. pilots flying for the French during the 1945 to 1954 period. But the Vietnamese, they never attacked New York. They never did anything to us except, and this goes all the way back to 1919 when Ho Chi Minh first expressed his friendship for the United States and asked for our support. This is a people and a nation that never did anything to us except ask for our friendship and support. And we killed 2 to 3 million Vietnamese. We lost the lives of 58,000, more than 58,000 Americans in that slaughterhouse that we turned Vietnam into.
It's Bruce Franklin. I'm afraid we have to leave it there. That's the subject of our next interview when you join us. Thank you so much for being with us today, H. Bruce Franklin.
Thank you, John. Right.
I'll let listeners know that H. Bruce Franklin's the author of the new piece, How Mitt Romney Dodged the Draft. It's in the new issue of the Counterpunch political newsletter, counterpunch.org. H. Bruce Franklin was at Stanford University teaching English, while Mitt Romney was a first-year student at Stanford in 1965. By then, H. Bruce Franklin had flown for 3 years in the U.S. Air Force as a Strategic Air Command navigator and intelligence officer. He'd been teaching a course also he has been teaching since 1981 on Vietnam at Rutgers with veterans among his students. He's worked in factories and was a tugboat mate and a deckhand. And he's also taught at Stanford, Johns Hopkins, Wesleyan, and Yale. Among the 19 books he's written or edited is War Stars, The Superweapon, and The American Imagination.